Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Mexico's drug war is spilling into the United States, and violence on the border is just the beginning. Mexican cartels have kidnapped hundreds for ransom in Phoenix. They've gained turf in U.S. cities large and small, from Atlanta to Anchorage. The U.S. military worries that Mexico's failed war on drugs is, quote, a failed state in the making. This hour On Point, Mexico, the U.S., and a drug war without borders. You can join our conversation. Can you imagine drug cartel kidnappings in major U.S. cities? How should President Obama respond to Mexico's drug war? Is it time for a new approach? Joining me first this hour from Phoenix, Arizona, is J.J. Hensley, staff reporter for the Arizona Republic. He's been reporting on the spike in kidnappings in Phoenix. J.J., welcome to On Point.
Hey, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Describe for us what's happening in Phoenix, now described as the kidnapping capital of America.
Yeah, that's not a very good moniker.
I
think in the last couple of years here, they've seen a spike of this kind of activity. And most of the local authorities are attributing it to kind of lower-level drug dealers who are looking for some quick cash or maybe to settle a score with someone who's gotten in trouble with them in the past. Mm.
And these kidnappings and related crimes becoming more and more violent and gruesome, as I've been reading, are they not?
They're certainly becoming more violent, and I mean, the techniques they're using, I guess, are more brazen, sort of storming into an occupied house in broad daylight and taking hostage whoever's inside. But, you know, the DEA, some of the folks that we talked to out here, especially for some of the recent stories we've done, they're very careful to make the distinction between what's going on here in Phoenix and in some other major cities and what's going on in Mexico, where those high-level, high-traffic organizations are targeting members of the Mexican military and the Mexican police.
So there is or is not a connection between what's going on in Phoenix and the Mexican drug cartels. I mean, what's at the heart of this then? Can it be traced there?
Yeah, I mean, the connection is drugs. The people who are victims in the crimes in Phoenix are drug dealers generally, and the people who are committing them are also drug dealers. They aren't. This is what the DEA says, that the people here doing this kind of crime aren't directly linked with these sort of large Mexican cartels that are, you know, doing the heinous beheadings and sort of public torture killings down in Mexico.
So how is law enforcement then concerned about the government response? Is there government response? Are they focused on this issue, the drug problem, the violence, the kidnappings? Is it being overlooked to some extent? Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, I mean, I think it's sort of finally raising to the level where law enforcement, at least in Phoenix, is aware of it. Tucson, a city of about 500,000 people, about 100 miles closer to the border than Phoenix, has been dealing with this issue for a couple of years also. And they have had a more coordinated response. But their response is coming on the prosecuting end. So after the crime occurs, they have a team there in their city or county prosecutor's office who works with state attorneys from the attorney general's office, and each of them kind of take a defendant because they are cases with two defendants generally.
Is there a sense that this is going to get worse before it gets better in Phoenix and surrounding areas?
Yeah, I haven't talked to anyone who's been able to kind of look in the crystal ball with any degree of authority on that. I mean, I feel like most of the federal and national and local agents we've talked to here think there probably will be more of this, if only out of kind of copycat crimes where people realize that there are a large number of drug stash houses here in Phoenix. It's a sort of a hub of drug activity from drugs being smuggled in from Mexico. So there's ample opportunity to drive around the city every day and target someone for this type of crime. Mm.
J.J. Hensley is a staff reporter for the Arizona Republic. J.J., thanks for the information. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Jane.
Later this hour, we'll touch down on the Tucson border with drug enforcement officials. But joining me first now from Washington is Andrew Seeley, director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Hello, Jane. Good to be with you today.
Thank you. And joining us in the studio is Alfredo Corchado, Mexican bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News and currently a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Alfredo, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
Let's start with you, Alfredo. Put this into perspective for us. We just heard about what's happening in Phoenix. Are there other American border towns seeing this kind of violence? I mean, give us a scale of this problem, more broadly speaking.
I think it's fair to say that most cities in the Southwest have seen some kind of violence, some kind of effects from the war in Mexico, the drug war in Mexico. We're talking about transnational gangs, and they have ties to cities, key cities in the Southwest, whether it's Dallas, whether it's Houston, San Antonio, Laredo, El Paso, Tucson, L.A. In the Dallas area, for example, there have been some killings that have been traced to drug traffickers. In Laredo, there were at least 84, 85 kidnapped Americans who ended up in the hands of drug traffickers. In El Paso, there's been less than a dozen, although we have to be careful here because many of the kidnappings are rarely reported to U.S. authorities.
So there may be more than we even know.
Exactly.
And so this point of the transnational gangs and the U.S. gangs, the ties to these gangs, there's essentially a partnership then going on.
Right. I mean,
across the border.
Right. I mean, think of it as any U.S. corporation that's out there trying to do their job and meet demand. There's demand across the United States for drug consumption. Drug traffickers in Mexico have aligned themselves with key U.S. gangs to try to, you know, make sure that their supply arrives on time.
Andrew Seeley, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff worries that Mexico is fast becoming, quote, a failed state because of the drug war and the increased violence. What does that mean for Mexico and for security in the United States?
Well, the Joint Chiefs of Staff report actually mentions the failed state idea as an extreme case. I don't think they actually think that Mexico is becoming a failed state in any way. They put that out there as a distant possibility. But there is clearly rising concern about the ability to deal with organized crime in Mexico and the Mexican government's ability to be able to respond to this, as well as, frankly, the U.S. response to this as well. Mexico is not close to being a failed state. I mean, this is a government that is extremely functional. But what is clear is that they have not been able to very effectively yet deal with organized crime. They've made great efforts on this. There's been extensive attempts both to strengthen the judicial system, improve the police forces that are there, try and go after some of the cartel leaders. But it's still, I mean, we're talking about organized crime that really deals in billions and billions of dollars. According to the Justice Department, there's about $15 to $25 billion that come back to Mexico every year from drug sales in the United States. So this is a very well-funded enterprise that has ability to do a lot of damage in Mexico. I think you're going to see the U.S. government over the next few years, particularly the Obama administration, trying to figure out what they can do both to help Mexico strengthen their institutions, strengthen their law enforcement capabilities, but also do things like try and slow the money trail from the United States back to Mexico, things we can do on our side of the border. And slow the flow of guns, which mostly come from the United States to Mexico as well, to the cartels.
I want to talk more about
those
policy.
Maybe refocusing on consumption.
Yeah, I want to talk more about those policy changes in just a bit, but I want to get to the heart of actually what's causing the violence in the first place. Alfredo Corchado, explain to us the competition that's going on in Mexico that's leading to this violence and the splintering of the cartels themselves.
You know, I'll give you a sense. There's, I guess, three stages in Mexico of what the situation is. First stage is when you have so much corruption among officials, people kind of look the other way. The second stage is when the peaceful coexistence between government and drug cartels is at risk, and that's exactly what we're seeing in Mexico today. The Calderón government 2 years ago began a strategy to go after cartels, and this has led to an internal fight among the cartels. There are mainly three cartels in Mexico. They're all vying for distribution routes to the United States.
That's the key, the distribution routes, how
right,
to get in.
Right, whether it's through Texas, through Arizona, to California. And that's really at the heart of the fight.
The U.S. government says that because of their crackdown, that those paths have been destabilized, and the old order of the cartels actually in Mexico has changed. Would you agree with that?
Yes, yes. I mean, definitely. That's really at the heart of the whole fight.
Andrew Seely, do you agree?
I agree. I mean, I think we've seen a couple of things. One is that the cartels are splintering a little bit. I wouldn't want to exaggerate it too much, but we've seen groups break off from a couple of the three large cartels, and are then fighting over territory with them over what they call plazas, over places where they can move their goods. And secondly, we're seeing, as near as we can tell, mid-level leaders have greater control over their actions. Before, the cartels were a little bit more hierarchical, and they were a little bit more business-oriented. And now we have some mid-level leaders who are a little bit more violent, who are trying to get attention, are trying to make their name known. And some of the more extreme actions we've seen in the last few months seem to be led by them.
So the cartels have traded the so-called business logic for more of a gang mentality, Alfredo. These low-level drug dealers feel more empowered in places like Phoenix to create and wreak havoc.
Right. I mean, you have a group, for example, in the Tamaulipas area, which is a Mexican state that borders Texas, a group called the Zetas. It's a paramilitary group that's the armed enforcement of the Gulf cartel. They are working hand-in-hand with another group in Central America, the Caibiles from Guatemala. And that's when this gruesome violence came about, the beheadings, the torture, extortions. I mean, it's a whole new level of doing business.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about Mexico's war on drugs and its deep reach into the United States. With us from Washington is Andrew Seely, director of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Mexico Institute. And with us in the studio is Alfredo Corchado, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. I want to follow up a little bit more on this point about the splintering of the cartels. Andrew Seely, I've heard at least one policy analyst compare Mexico to Afghanistan because of the small insurgent groups that have splintered from the cartel. Would that be an accurate comparison?
Well, I think Mexico is fairly different. I mean, in Afghanistan, you have a situation where there's never been centralized politics, where politics was always run by warlords. It was sort of a brief time of the Taliban, obviously. But Mexico really does have a much, much stronger state, much more of a government that actually has a reach everywhere. I mean, you go almost anywhere, every village, and there's education, for example. There's a strong government presence. What we are seeing, however, is groups outside that, right? Groups which are able to, they're not interested in taking over the government, but they are interested, they're not interested in running the functions of the government, but they just want to do their business, and they have the ability to do that, and the government can't do anything about that. And two places we've seen that very strongly. One is in Tijuana, where what was the Tijuana cartel has been very hit by the government, and you're starting to see some of the groups that were, some of the people that were in the Tijuana cartel splitting off and trying to do their own business, and also in Sinaloa, with the Beltran Leyva brothers who have sort of split off from the main group there and have become incredibly violent and vying for power in some of the old roots that the Sinaloa cartel had.
Alfredo Corchado, aren't there stories, though, of some of these border towns, especially in the Mexican side, where the cartels are essentially running the place? Government is out of power. Nobody's in control but the cartel and the drug lords.
I mean, I think some Mexican officials will tell you that almost 10% of Mexican territory is now in the hands of cartels, that they are the ultimate authority. And, you know, if I can just add to what Andrew was saying, one of the big, big concerns in Mexico, it's not so much that it'll become a failed state, but that corruption is so vast and it permeates local, state, and federal government, that's really what's at risk here. You're also talking about a very young democracy. It's a very fragile democracy. Again, Mexico was governed by the PRI for 71 years. The opposition government took over. It's now almost 9 years. And it's a system that's slowly rotting away because of the cartel power.
Andrew Seely, you talked a little bit before the break about U.S. demand. How much of the Mexico drug problem is being driven by demand in the U.S.? I think you mentioned, $15 to $20 billion in drug sales going back to Mexico every year. How much are we at fault here? Are we to blame?
Well, I think it's a joint responsibility. I mean, there are at least two causes of why this is happening now. One is clearly demand. I mean, we have an insatiable demand for illicit drugs in the U.S. depending what figures you believe, and they're hard to come by these days, the drug demand in the U.S. is fairly constant, and we haven't made as strong inroads as we might have in demand. And most, you know, Mexico is our neighbor, and it's a country that has worked very well as a place to traffic cocaine coming from South America, but also produce methamphetamines and marijuana and heroin for the U.S. market. Now, Mexico is developing its own demand as well. There's the beginning of a drug problem. It's becoming more severe every day in Mexico. The cartels have discovered that it's good to create their own homegrown market in case things close up on the U.S. side. The other thing going on, of course, is, as Alfredo said, I mean, Mexico is a new democracy, and it's also a country with very weak judicial institutions, with very weak police forces, which were created for an authoritarian government. And before they've been able really to try and reform those and make them work for democracy, the cartels have come in and been able to corrupt a lot of the system. And so you have a country that's trying very hard to create good, solid institutions for democracy, and at the same time is seeing those corrupted day by day. And, you know, when you've got a major market in your neighboring country and you've got weak institutions in your own country, that's a recipe for disaster.
Alfredo Corchado, what are your thoughts? I mean, indicators show American consumption has only increased. Is there hope that a diminishment of that would actually help with trade on the other side of the border?
Well, you know, there was a report last week issued by the three former heads of state from Brazil, Colombia, and Mexico that essentially called the 40-year-old U.S. drug policy a failure. And said it's time for the United States to at least begin to debate whether to decriminalize drugs, for example, marijuana, because I don't see this getting any better. I mean, as bad as it is in Mexico today, it hasn't reached the Colombia level.
Let's bring a caller into this conversation at this point from Burlington, Vermont. Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris. Thanks for your call.
Hi,
thanks,
Jane.
For waiting.
Hi. Thanks, panel.
Thank you.
I guess what we were just talking about is what leads me to my question. What if the United States legalized drugs and had it be controlled? Wouldn't that just totally take the whole money system out and just turn the system onto ourselves?
Chris, thank you. Andrew, excuse me, would you like to talk about that, the legalization? Would that help stop the problem?
Sure. In theory, if we could regulate the market, it probably would help undermine the cartels and allow them to be regulated. It might have some other negative side effects. I don't see that debate happening in the U.S., though, and perhaps it's something that will come over the next few years. I think what we can do in the short term, though, that is very valuable, we moved away from prevention and treatment of drugs over the past few years. I mean, it became the idea of sort of helping addicts get clean was no longer a very attractive idea for policymakers. But in fact, you know, it's one of the most effective things we can do to undermine the cartels is investing in getting addicts, you know, off addiction, getting trying to prevent young people from getting into drugs in the first place. The more we can invest in that on our side of the border, the more we dry up the market for the cartels. Now, it's never going to go away. I mean, it's impossible to do that short of trying to regulate the market. We can't do that by legalizing it. But it is a way, at least in the short term, things like drug courts that provide alternative sentencing really do help at least limit the market and hurt the cartels' bottom lines and their businesses in the end.
I mean, I'll just add that since 2002, I think 57% of all U.S. spending in the drug war has gone towards disrupting the drug supply, and less than 3% has gone into the treatment program or the whole issue of treating the problem as a health issue. And that's something that Latin American countries continues to insist, is that Americans or the United States needs to stop being so hypocritical about this. I mean, it is an issue. It's a big, big problem. And if the Mexicans go away tomorrow, who's coming in to take their place, you know?
Here's another call from Robert in Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Robert. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just got a couple of things to mention. A lot of people don't actually look on the other side of the coin. I'm a truck driver, professional truck driver. I drive all 48 states.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been I've been at least in 10 border towns in the last five to six years in Laredo, Mexicali, Juarez, all those cities, they are bad, you know, and they're all right, but what I was, every time I go down there to buy stuff for my house, houseware items, and a lot of the locals tell me that it's just like any major city in the United States, if you go looking for trouble, you're going to find trouble.
So you've always, Robert, you've always felt safe down when you go to Mexico. You've never seen any of this.
Well, I've you kind of feel the tension in the air. But the problem is the people down there that are trying to survive like us are hurting from this, because a lot of the tourists that go over there to buy stuff, you know, are scared to go. And I can't blame them, because I'm Hispanic, and I see a lot of Caucasian people that usually end up getting them taken for their money or abused and stuff. But, I mean, it's sad, because their economy is worse than ours, and they're suffering even more than us because, you know, I mean, they told everybody that I talk to, I never have a problem. I go down there and eat smallies and have a good time. And it's just that it's sad because they're hurting, and it gives them such a negative, you know, perspective. Everybody thinks the negative, that when you go over there, you're going to get kidnapped, robbed, which is not always true.
Not always the case. Robert, thanks so much for bringing that up. Talk about what's going on culturally and economically in Mexico, Alfredo. The deepening U.S. recession, the Mexican recession. I mean, a lot of this is contributing to what's going on, and the violence and the increases.
Right, and that is a huge concern. I mean, just along the U.S.-Mexico border, you are seeing more and more Mexicans pick up and move to the U.S. side. And the caller's right. I mean, if you go to Juarez today, especially during the daytime, things appear to be calm. But then there comes a time during the day that it's like, I need to get back to the U.S. side. And that, I mean, I have friends who no longer go to the airport, for example. I think one friend, for the last time she went to Juarez, saw a headless body, you know, from a bridge. And if you're a border chamber of commerce guy, that's not the look you're going for.
What about the midterm elections? What about politically, Alfredo? Coming up this summer, midterm elections, I mean, how is this all going to play? How are the Mexican people feeling about this instability in their own country?
Well, that is the big worry because, again, I was talking about three stages, and the second stage is peaceful coexistence. The third stage that Mexicans are concerned about is when the cartels begin to try to take over their democracy. Again, it's a very young, very fragile democracy. You have midterm elections coming up, the possibility of cartel money, narco money infiltrating the election is a real possibility, and that is a huge concern.
Back to the phones now. In Boston, Barbara is on the line. Hi, Barbara. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
You know, this story is kind of hitting home with me because I have a very close college friend whose husband is a professional negotiator down in, he lives in Miami, but he works with the Mexico and the Colombian government. And he, I don't know if Mr. Cricaccio has heard of him before, but Felix Batista, he disappeared December 10th, which was a couple months ago in Mexico, and he actually does negotiating as a profession, and there's been no communication, no ransom. And I guess my question would be if he has heard of him, and if there's any cooperation between the two countries in the way of intelligence or a task force or something that keeps an eye on American citizens, especially in the public eye like Felix, that are victims to these situations. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen much media coverage at all regarding Felix's disappearance.
Barbara, thank you. Alfredo?
Yes, I mean, there has been a lot of publicity in Mexico. He was, I think, if memory serves well, he was at a restaurant with some clients, took a call, went outside, never came back. Last thing I've heard is that there has been cooperation between the state authorities and the U.S. authorities, but to date, no news about Felix.
Andrew Seeley, we don't hear much about the drug war in the U.S., unless it's in these particular cities that are hardest hit. It's fallen off the map politically here because of all that's going on. Does Mexico have a partner in the U.S. in this effort?
You know, I think Mexico does, but you're right. It hasn't been as big a story as it has been. We're obviously concerned about the economic crisis and other things going on in this country right now. But there has been a growing cooperation on intelligence between the two governments. This is something that's happened over the past 10 years, but it's really, we've seen it ramp up over the past couple of years. Significantly, there's some law enforcement cooperation going on, trying to track people as they move across the border. There is the beginnings of a partnership. Clearly, there's a lot more that we can do. And one of the things that then-President-elect Obama committed himself to doing when he met with President Calderon of Mexico was trying to figure out what we can do on this side, both to support Mexico's efforts, try and deepen this kind of intelligence cooperation, law enforcement cooperation, but also seeing what we can do about guns that are going across the border.
Mm-hmm.
Huge market for guns on the U.S. side, which are flowing across regularly and arming the cartels. about the money trail and also about consumption. And I think there is a commitment to do that. We'll have to see. Clearly, President Obama is dealing with a number of other issues right now. But when the administration can start to put together a comprehensive strategy that really backs up what the Mexicans are doing.
Well, Alfredo, President Calderon is not the first Mexican president to crack down on drug trafficking. I mean, I remember interviewing President Vicente Fox at the Presidential Palace in Mexico City just a few years ago, and he was talking about a crackdown. I mean, what does success look like politically and practically speaking there and here?
It's a very good question. Again, you know, Laredo, or the city of Nuevo Laredo across Laredo, Texas, was one of the first hard-hit cities. And for a while, that's where the attention was. That's where the news was, where the cartels essentially took over the city. What does success look like? If you talk to the mayor today of Nuevo Laredo, he will say the city is back to normal. Please, Texans, come back for spring break. But if you talk to locals there, they will tell you it's normal because one cartel won, and one cartel essentially has control over the city. It's returned to a peaceful coexistence. Now, that's the last thing that American authorities want to hear. They don't want to go back to the peaceful coexistence situation. They want to be able to control the cartels. They want to use the word eradicate. I think what they really want to do in the short term is control the violence.
Andrew, do you agree?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's actually not a lot of clarity yet on what the end game is for both countries in this. Where we've ended up in the United States is not in eradicating drug trafficking, but we've been able to control it in such a way that it's primarily a public health issue and a public security issue in cities and towns and counties around the United States. Doesn't mean it's good. It's still a major problem in this country, but it's not a threat to national security. If we go back to the 1980s, there was a time in this country during the crack boom when we really started to worry that drug trafficking was something that could not destabilize the country, of course, but really create some major upheavals in American communities. We've managed to manage it since then. And it's not clear what the end game is for Mexico or the end game between the United States and Mexico, but clearly it's going to end up being some sort of management where, you know, if both countries are successful in this, it's not a threat to national security, it's not a threat to Mexican democracy, but it's also probably not completely eradicated.
Alfredo Corchado, you've been covering this story for a long time, Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Have you felt personally threatened in the reporting of this, in gathering information and uncovering many, many stories related to the drug trafficking and drug war in Mexico and the U.S.?
At one point in my life, I used to cover U.S. policy to Latin America, which is a really relatively safe job. Yes, there have been threats, but nothing compared to what my colleagues in Mexico are receiving. I mean, since 2000, more than 30 journalists have either been killed or kidnapped. And I think the border, U.S.-Mexico border, safe to say, is one of the most dangerous assignments for any reporter. That's one reason why I'm enjoying my fellowship so much this year.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about Mexico's drug war and how it affects both sides of the border. Alfredo Corchado is with us. He's Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Also with us is Andrew Seeley. He directs the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining us from Tucson, Arizona, is Anthony Coulson. He's Assistant Special Agent in charge at the Drug Enforcement Agency in Tucson. Tony, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jane.
So describe the competition among the drug cartels for access to U.S. borders.
Well, it's fierce. You know, we're talking a $10, $20, $30 billion industry in profits, and that competition is very stiff. Especially when you have such pressure that the Mexican military and Mexican government is putting on, for certain corridors, the competition gets even greater.
And how is that compared to years ago, even 4 or 5 years ago?
4 or 5 years ago, it was less so, and drugs flowed freely through here. We had a tremendous problem with methamphetamine and cocaine. We've done a great job with methamphetamine, but marijuana still ranks up there pretty high in terms of what's coming through. So we've seen an increased competition, and with that comes an increased amount of violence on the south side of the border that we've seen.
So it's harder to get across? Has the fence been effective? I mean, what's working
yes.
for you?
The fence has been extremely effective. Instead of, you know, vehicles getting in, crossing the border and getting to our highway system within minutes, we're now talking hours to days. We're pushing them out into the desert where it's more easily, they're more vulnerable for exploitation and to be captured when they're out in the desert that far. And gives us some time before they get into the blood system of America, which is our highway system.
As a DEA agent, Tony, I mean, how do you see this violence increasing in the United States? I mean, why do you see it spilling into so many American cities? Is it just simply that competition for access?
Well, you know, we actually are not seeing the spillover violence from the cartels into the U.S. What we are seeing is trafficker-on-trafficker violence in the U.S. increasing. Hmm. Most of that is in because of debt or stealing money, something that's been involved between the traffickers on this side. We see very little evidence of the cartels actually directing violent activities into the U.S. And they won't do that because that'll bring increased attention to something that they've already seen a tremendous amount of attention already from the Mexican government. They don't want to come into the U.S. And have a whole lot of attention that they would get if they increased direct cartel violence into the U.S. But we have seen some increase in trafficker-directed violence in the U.S., and we have seen, on the human smuggling side, an increase to violence on that side also.
How are traffickers getting around the DEA? How are they innovating, Tony?
They're very smart. These are not, you know, they are thugs. They are relatively uneducated, but they are tremendously intelligent in terms of who they bring in to do their work for them. They have tremendous logistical chain to get drugs from South America through Mexico into the U.S. They have tremendous growing operations in Mexico for marijuana. They have a tremendous, you know, influence in the corruption of Mexican law enforcement, and they're very good at it. They do counterintelligence on us. They study the cases that we have in the U.S. to see where their vulnerabilities lie in terms of informants and how sophisticated we are with our technology. Many things that they watch and they do. They are very, very good. And you would normally see that with a corporation that has billions of dollars in terms of assets.
I mean, I've heard stories of submarines being sent up the coast to, you know, get around the border.
Submarines, aircraft, you name it, they will find a way to get it in. Sophisticated traps in vehicles or sophisticated compartments that are very difficult to find. The corruption that they used, even corrupting our own law enforcement on the U.S. side. Tremendous amount of money, assets, time that they spend on perfecting the drug trafficking trade.
So, Tony Colson, where do you see the drug war going in the U.S.?
Well, I actually see some very good things happening. As we move on, the federal government gets more in tune with a strategy that aligns all our agencies from Border Patrol, ICE, DEA, FBI, to our state and local counterparts in terms of how we tier and attack these traffickers in order to impact them, in order to make the cost of things go up. Here in Arizona, we aligned ourselves with former Governor Napolitano, now the Secretary of Homeland Security, in coming up with a comprehensive mess strategy. And that federal to state to street level strategy with our treatment and prevention partners, you know, reduce methamphetamine availability by 50%, increase the price to double, and, you know, now we have 50% of our kids in high school looking less contact with methamphetamine. That is a tremendous success story, and those are some of the models that we're putting in place to increase our effectiveness from top to bottom. Well, there's a comprehensive strategy from prevention, treatment, and law enforcement.
Well, best of luck to you. We appreciate your time today. Anthony Coulson is Assistant Special Agent in Charge at the Drug Enforcement Administration. Tony, thanks.
Thank you.
Back to the phones now. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Dennis is on the line. Dennis, thanks for waiting. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi, fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I was just wondering, do you think that the immigration policies that we had the past 3 years really contributed to this? Due to the fact that, you know, I mean, pretty sure almost millions of Mexicans were deported and they don't have work. And that will just make the cartel more, I guess it will give them more of a power, right?
Mm. Dennis, thanks. Andrew Seeley, you want to tackle that? Immigration policies of the last 3 or 4 years under the past administration, what effect have they had?
You know, I'm not sure immigration policy has had that much of an effect. There was certainly an increase in the number of deportations, but I'm not sure it's a direct effect. But clearly the immigration policies are, you know, just on the face of it, the one thing everyone agrees on make no sense at all anyway. We have a situation where we basically have 12 million people living in this country without documents, a large number of them, a little over half probably Mexican, but from many other countries. And we can have people arriving every year without documents. And we don't have actually visas that are worker-based. We have very few out there, but very few at all, though we have a huge demand in the United States for workers from abroad. And so there's some real need to do some rethinking of our immigration system, recreate our visa system. It doesn't tie in directly, perhaps, to this. And my sense is actually we've confused the issue sometimes by trying to think about security at the border against drug traffickers and also against immigrants. What we actually could do that would make much more sense is try and get a sensible visa policy that allows people in a regulated way and then use our enforcement at the border to go against drug trafficking.
Alfredo Corchado, is it possible to have a more liberal immigration policy and staunch the overflow of drug violence?
Well, I'll tell you what's happened in the last few years with the increased border security, and there's been some unintended consequences of the immigration policy. And by that I mean it's becoming much more lucrative, much more expensive to get America's illegal workforce into the United States. That means that cartels are now taking over human smuggling routes. Mm. On the Mexican side, it also means that young kids who one day dreamed of coming to the United States, whether to work in L.A. or work in New York or Texas, now grow up wanting to be hitmen. You know, I was struck in the state of Sinaloa, bordering the U.S., where young kids, you know, would tell me, well, yeah, at one point I did want to grow up to go to the United States and work. And now I find that it's much more lucrative to become a hitman and have my SUV by the time I'm 20, buy my parents a home. They know they're going to live a very short life. And so they're thinking in terms of the next, you know, 10, 15 years.
Culturally, things are changing.
Right, right.
Back to the phones now. Charlottesville, Virginia. Sarah's on the line. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to On Point. Sarah, you there?
Yes.
Hi. Go ahead. Thank you for calling.
Aloha. I wanted to know, and I suppose this couldn't be directed to Mr. DEA, is who is looking at the U.S. government? Because, you know, with this obvious disorganization, inside the organized crime, the splintering of these cartels, is there a more, you know, a more whole cartel? Is there, you know, who is looking at the U.S. side of things and trying to see who is, you know, running the puppet show from here? Because there are people letting things in, and the fact is that without that, it wouldn't be happening.
Sarah, thanks. Andrew Seeley, your response?
Yeah, I think that that's a key question. There are a number of efforts going on, as Tony talked about, trying to get local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies on the same page. Clearly, a lot more can be done on that. Clearly, corruption happens on this side of the border as well, though there are more accountability mechanisms. The judicial system works actually fairly well, so that there's greater incentives not to do things. But also because the drug trade seems to be much more decentralized on the U.S. side. Mm. And so once it comes in, you know, people are caught, but it's harder to sort of dismantle the whole operation. In Mexico, it's much more concentrated. But clearly this is a huge issue. And it's one of the things that the Mexican government and other governments in Latin America frequently ask the U.S. government about is, you know, what can be done on the U.S. side? What is sort of the counterpart to what we're experiencing? And we don't know enough about that yet.
Mm. Alfredo?
I was just going to add that over 50% of all proceeds from drug profits go into corrupting law enforcement on the Mexican side. Hmm. And increasingly much of that is also reaching the U.S. side of the border. I mean, U.S. law enforcement are increasingly accused and convicted of corruption.
Back to the phones. Ames, Iowa. Stefan is on the line. Hi, Stefan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I grew up in Colombia, South America, and the violence there had specific causes, but over many, many decades, it proliferated so that, for example, kidnappings for ransom are almost or perhaps more profitable than the drug trade. And I'm afraid that Mexico is disintegrating beyond these specific sources of violence, such as the drug trade. And I guess I'm wondering if your guests would have any observations about that. I think the comparison with Colombia is much better than Afghanistan.
Mm, Stefan, thanks. What do you think? Do you agree, Alfredo?
Yes. I mean, in Colombia, I think in 1 year they recorded 40,000 deaths. And then I think it was 89, it was 25,000. Again, Mexico is not at that level. As bad as it is, it will get worse. And I think many Mexicans are very, very cognizant of the fact that we're headed Colombia's way.
Tom is on the line now from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program.
Hi. It seems that there must be kind of a complicity on both sides of the border with the authorities. I mean, how does all these drugs get through to the U.S. side and all these arms and weapons go straight back to the Mexican side?
Tom, thanks. What's the flow about, Alfredo?
I mean, again, there has been a lot more corruption on the U.S. side, policies and you know that are not working. As Andrew was saying earlier, over 90% of all guns used in Mexico come from the United States. Drug proceeds, cash bulk going back to Mexico. There's a lot of room for more increased cooperation between both governments.
Andrew Seeley, I want to talk endgame here as far as the Obama administration and new policy. We touched on it a bit, but is there room now for intelligence assistance, military help in Mexico? I mean, will there be an enhanced role for the U.S. against the cartels upcoming?
Well, there has been. There's actually Congress approved $400 million last year to support Mexico's efforts, primarily equipment, training, technology. I think that's going to continue over the next few years.
And the Merida initiative, I mean, that was $1.4 billion there.
Yeah, exactly. And we've done the first $400 million, and we'll see. It's supposed to be $1.4 billion over 3 years. My guess is it will be extended over a longer period of time. This is a long-term cooperation. And part of what that's generating is new forms of interaction between law enforcement authorities on both sides of the border, actually sitting down trying to figure out now that we're working together on this, what else can we be doing? And it's creating some horizontal relationships that I think are very useful. When you talk to law enforcement authorities on both sides, they're sort of discovering a level of trust they didn't have in the past. But the other thing, and to pick up on what Alfredo was saying, I think, you know, arms trafficking, for example, until a few months ago, we had about 100 ATF inspectors down in the border region, fairly small number for a 2,000-mile border. And, you know, we certainly don't want to undermine the Second Amendment, but it's illegal to knowingly sell weapons to someone who's going to use it in a criminal enterprise. It's, of course, illegal to export them without a license. And so there's a lot of room to really go after the people that are selling weapons to drug traffickers or those that are serving as intermediaries, purchasing them and then reselling them to drug traffickers to track those folks. Clearly need more inspectors. There's some talk on the Hill right now. 57 members of Congress just sent a letter this week to President Obama suggesting that he change the definition of sporting weapons that can be imported into the United States. Mm. One of the things that's happened in the past few years is that very high-caliber weapons were allowed to be imported to the United States for the first time. And what it's done is really lower the cost of high-caliber weapons on the open market. Mm. And so one of the ideas that's coming out of Congress is, look, if we can go back to where we were, where high-caliber weapons can't be imported, there's still a lot produced in the United States. They're still going to be sold, but they'll be much more expensive, and it's going to hit the bottom line of the cartels.
Alfredo Corchado, just a few seconds left. Are Mexicans culturally prepared for some sort of joint operation with the U.S. in this drug war? I mean, in some corridors, I'm reading that would be seen as an affront to Mexican sovereignty in some way.
Well, I mean, it depends who you talk to. If you're talking to Mexicans in the northern part, the people who are really being impacted greatly by the drug violence, they will not rule that out. If you talk to people in Mexico City, it's a sovereignty issue. However, if you start seeing high-level assassinations take place, I think all bets are off.
What an interesting and insightful conversation. My thanks to all my guests. Alfredo Corchado is Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, currently a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Alfredo, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.
Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Andrew Seeley is Director of the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Andrew, thank you to you.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.